You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we would debate abortion, but I vetoed the topic before it could be brought up. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if you love dad jokes and politically incorrect takes, then you have landed in the right spot here in the midside. Pull up a chair. Actually, you don't have to pull up a chair. You can be doing this while you're doing anything. So you know what? Pick up some weights. Lift some weights while you're listening to this episode. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Yeah, I live in a place that I feel like could explode at any moment. And I don't mean because I live in a house built in the 50s and we have terrible gas lines, because we don't. I mean that I lived in D.C. through the Kavanaugh stuff. I lived in D.C. through the Trump election. Right now, it feels like at any moment, any person on the street could just go postal. It is a very strange culture here in the district at the moment.
This is in reference to the Alabama abortion law?
Yes, and the basically quote-unquote foregone conclusion that the Supreme Court is ready to overturn Roe v. Wade. I don't think that's foregone in any way whatsoever, but that is the strange ether in which I must navigate my life in the current D.C. climate.
Well, not to get ahead of ourselves and go into the news, but didn't I say this, or did you say it, or we both agreed? We probably both agreed. But during the Kavanaugh thing, didn't we say that this is what they were trying to, the left was trying to basically market as how the right wing was going to go? And it shows how people buy what the left markets still in this day and age. People buy into the myth they market.
Yeah, it's. I think both teams, the D's and the R's, are pretty much on point at the moment. And so when both teams play on point, it gets a lot of the backseat commentators going, "See, I told you so." They did exactly what they said they would do. So it's weird here. How is it by you, Justin?
I'm looking outside and there's actually rain right now. So
rain?
Weird.
That?
Yeah, I know. I mean, come on. Do you really want me to go into another rant about California?
No, you should just bring in the other guy.
In the good news, no. First, in the good news, I finally got, but by the way, I'm a state employee, but dealing with the state. So I applied March 8th is when Florida got my transcripts for a teaching certificate, because I wanted to know what the next steps I had to take were. So I called them this week. And they said, "Oh, yeah, we have a lot of people applying, so there's a huge backlog, so we can't give you a timeline as to when we're going to reply to your application." Do you want to know how long it took them to reply to my application?
Shorter than a wait at a California DMV.
Correct. 3 hours.
Yeah.
So 3 hours later, they replied, and basically I'm eligible for a temporary certificate as long as I get hired and fingerprinted. And then I just have to take some tests, and like they want me to take extra classes in order to get a professional license. But I can do that while I'm teaching for 3 years in Florida. So there is light at the end of the tunnel here. All I need to do is get a job in Florida teaching, and I can get out of California. So,
wow, look at that. There is a life after California, Justin, I promise.
Yeah, it's like other states actually want you to do your work. I mean, the idea that you can get a temporary certificate and teach while getting credentialed, like, why did no one in California think of that? It's like, it makes so much sense.
Because California has a stronger teachers union.
100%. All right, let's bring in the other guy now. Also joining us this trip, from Dale's Lawn, forgoing his white male gay privilege by identifying as a woman, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, the sprinkling continues in California. Are we still, should we still be rationing water? Are the sprinklers still going? Yeah.
The sprinkling sounds like a horror movie. It's like the Sprinkles Cupcakes takes over the world and, like, poisons everyone. The sprinkling.
Well, certainly people driving on the roads, it does look like a horror movie right now. That's true. No one knows how to drive.
I thought it was
any amount of
participation. I thought it was an HBO movie about the Trump pee-pee tapes, but...
Honestly, William, the number one reason I want to get out of California is the driving. I can't deal with the driving anymore. It's insane.
Yeah, I think people figure that the reason Teslas are so popular is because of the virtue signaling, and that's certainly a large part of it. But in California, it's probably the autonomous driving is probably like a safety necessity. I mean, the kinds of crazy driving you see everywhere, the kinds of cars that are on the road are just amazing. And I mean, amazingly bad. Amazingly bad.
And you want to talk about these hybrid vehicles? You want to talk about a horror movie? I can't hear them coming. At least if somebody's driving poorly and they have a regular combustion engine, I can hear them. But it's like they sneak up on you and then they like cut you off. And you're like, where'd you come from?
Where'd you come from, Leaf?
All right. Speaking about where did you come from? How about this new stuff with the SAT? Huh? I was like, ooh. How did that come? That came out of nowhere. That wasn't foreshadowed. Talk about not foreshadowing something and not setting it up. No, we're not going to talk about Game of Thrones next. It's time for the news. Let's go into it in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad.
For all of you out there who already know about our Patreon, patreon.com/themidside, we thank you very much for being Patreon subscribers. Patreon allows you to give us a couple bucks every time we produce one of these phenomenal shows for you, the audience, and that really helps us pay for hosting and a slew of other things. So patreon.com/themidside. The New York Times reports that the SAT is about to get an adversity score. And they're answering some questions about it. Indeed, the College Board, which is the company that administers the SAT exam, unveiled a new tool for admissions officers this week that measures the economic and social adversity that test takers have faced. The adversity score, which the College Board calls a measure of, quote, disadvantage, is meant to help schools diversify their student bodies without looking explicitly at race. So here's how the ratings work. The score includes 31 pieces of information meant to measure social disadvantage across two broad categories, the student's neighborhood and the student's school. None of the factors directly reflect an individual student. All of them are about the census tract in which the student and his or her classmates live. The goal is to find students who have transcended their environments by examining factors that are correlated, according to research, with lower academic achievement and lower lifetime earnings. So, Justin, here are some of the factors. Median family income, percentage of households in poverty, percentage of single-parent households, percentage of vacant housing units, percentage of adults without a high school degree, percentage of adults without a college degree, percentage of adults with agriculture jobs, and of course, unemployment and crime rates. Students will receive a score between 1 and 100. Justin, what would your disadvantage score be? Like, if one was most advantage and 100 was most disadvantage, what would your score have been growing up? Like negative 40?
I mean, I'm tempted to say 108 just because I always say 108 when people ask for a random number. This is no different than when we took those. What was it? One of the midsiders showed us that test in her school of what your oppression score? What was that?
What's your privileges?
Your privilege score. That's it. And we were super high on the privilege scale too, right? I mean, the only thing I'm really technically quote-unquote unprivileged about is that I'm an atheist because we live in a Christian culture, so that makes me unprivileged because people go around asking my religion, right? You know how many discussions I have about being an atheist every day that makes me unprivileged? And then...
Well, for the record, you guys all had lots of privilege. I had no privilege, if you remember.
I have some not privilege.
Stop speaking as a woman. You're still a white male.
Yeah. White male, gay guy.
Yeah. I mean, look, here's the thing, right? This reminds me of one of those, you know how we love to make fun of, and I've been thinking about this a lot recently, actually. Not this specific example, but this concept, this principle. You know how we make fun of in this country and we sort of undermine the idea that America used to be better with the whole 50s mentality and the whole Pleasantville? You know, they made that movie making fun of that whole mentality where everybody knew each other and they were nice to each other and they could, you know, leave the doors unlocked, things like that. Well,
sure.
My dad, like, tells a story about that with credit scores. He's really annoyed about credit scores now because he's like, when I was young, you know, when we were younger, you know, you used to go in and they would talk to you and they would know you and they would decide to give you things based upon that. And credit was part of that equation. Now it's just all of it. It's just an equation. They put an equation into a computer and then it just spits it out. And the person just tells you yes or no based upon what the computer spits out. There's no knowing people anymore. There's no figuring out who individuals are and the way their personalities are and what they've achieved. And it's the same thing with this test. The college admissions process should not just be statistics on a page and you pick based upon the statistics. There should be a way of getting to know these people and what they're individually achieving. But now we're just going to make it even more statistical with this adversity score where it's like, oh, well, based upon the numbers of where this person lived and based upon what their GPA is and their extracurriculars and scores on this test, therefore we should let them in. It's the same exact thing where you're just, it's all going to be computerized at a certain point. And that's taking the humanity out of everything because it's taking the individualism out of everything.
Yes, it's certainly something that eschews individual achievement for socioeconomic and cultural environment, which is strange since you have no choice over that. William, education experts are also skeptical of the new tool, but here's why. I want to get your reaction to this. Sean Reardon, a professor of education at Stanford University, said this about the new tool. If you're a really well-educated, higher-income family living in a poor neighborhood, this measure is going to overstate the disadvantage you face. So, William, the education experts are skeptical because they think it'll still help the advantaged who are now gentrifying the poor, disadvantaged neighborhoods. What say you?
Yeah, I think with any measure like this, we're going to measure environmental data and draw conclusions about an individual. It's going to be gamified. Like, why wouldn't a rich person that wants to get into Harvard just move to Kentucky, like some like poor coal town that's all dried up for the last year of school? Like, this will guarantee them an entrance into Harvard, right? They'll push their score up to 100. I think that's certainly a concern, right? Because you're not looking at the individual. You're doing exactly what I rail against all the time, which is applying characteristics of a group to an individual blindly, right? With no other data, right? And they have data available to them, right? They have the score, the actual SAT score, and the rest of the application.
Yeah, it's to me, to both of you, sort of just another reason why colleges are becoming totally obsolete in how they deal with people. As the college admissions standards become more and more woke, you're just going to admit students and basically ruin their lives by saddling them with debts and not give them anything. Because it's not about what a student can get out of college anymore. It's about, you know, we have all these lower income kids and we're just going to now give them a bunch of debt and move them through the system and stamp them with a sociology degree. And when they get out, there's no jobs to be had for that. So this to me is just another toll in the death knell of the university, and good riddance.
Yeah. I want to take a different a look from a different lens on this. So the only reason I got into undergrad was because I was from an underrepresented county. I got as many in the illegal scoring system that was the University of Michigan scoring system back then. I was an underrepresented county, which got me the same amount of scores as same amount of like points as being a black from Detroit. And that's how I got in to my undergrad. It was in exactly just like the system that they described here, except for this one doesn't take into account race. Now, do I think I didn't deserve to be at Michigan? Well, I do think I deserve to be there. I was one of the top people in my high school. So like if you measure me in context of what I was achieving, what according to what was available to me, that it makes a lot of sense. But the problem is that there's no that system didn't get it that right by being better, right? By being objective. It got it right by accident, right? They were trying to do this thing to just take into account race that was found unconstitutional, and I just happened to like just by being who I was and growing up where I did, get the required number of points to get let in. This system at least is a little better, right? It's using objective characteristics, and it might be tempting to say like, oh, well, this sounds better than just saying, oh, you're black, you get in, you're Asian, you don't get in, you're white, you don't get in. It sounds better than that. But you have to remember, they're engineering this to select for things that they think is attributed to race in this country. So some of this doesn't make any sense. And I posted another article that Justin says was duplicative, but it was an opinion piece also in the New York Times where they broke this down. And they talked about how you can't really look at some of these characteristics and say that gives you an advantage or disadvantage because you don't know what that meant to that person in the context of their life. Like think about like if you're even inside a family, right? Siblings can experience different environments over the time that they're growing up. And you don't just look and say, look at their external environment, meaning like what neighborhood they live in, which a lot of these are just looking at what neighborhood they're living in or what neighborhood their school's in, and can draw conclusions. It just doesn't work. And you can't take what, like Justin was saying, you can't take the individual and just like look at where they are from and draw any conclusions about it. It doesn't work like that. You can certainly use it as a factor, but it's a factor to point you in which questions to ask, like in an interview or a college essay, right?
Right. I mean, look, I'm going to use the metaphor that I probably should have used 5 minutes ago, but it's the equivalent of picking players based upon statistics. You know, how well they performed on the field, supposedly, statistics as the measure of how well they performed on the field, and looking at their socioeconomic background to decide who stays on your team and who gets signed and who gets cut. And as we've all seen from Bill Belichick, it has a lot more to do, it has to do with a lot more than statistics when you're signing these players. You have to sit down and talk to them and find out what kind of decision-making process they have. You have to find out how they deal with problems that are presented to them. And dealing with adversity isn't like, oh, how many 2-minute drives have they been a part of on, you know, that have been successful, or how many comebacks have they been part of that has been successful. You can never quantify any of those things, because what you're not looking at is how their mind operates when you're doing that.
I think all that is correct, except that the schools don't care.
Oh, 100%. That's the
and
problem.
What I mean is that there's no, you know, the sort of benevolent premise of this discussion is that schools are interested in getting the best thinkers, or schools are interested in getting the smartest kids, or whatever you want to say about it. They're not. Schools are interested in getting the most woke kids. Schools are interested in getting the kids whose minds they can shape into being social justice warriors, and then saddle them with debt and get them out of here. They're not any more interested in the best and brightest thinkers, at least for the most part, save for select schools.
Daniel, I think it's worse than that.
That's why I think the university system needs to die.
They are interested in tipping the scales and putting more of the lesbian, transsexual, one-legged women of black and Hispanic descent into college. They want those checkboxes. They want to virtue signal their diversity, right? They don't want real diversity, right? They don't want actual intellectual diversity. And they're going to, no matter what criteria they select, if it doesn't give them more blacks and less Asians and whites, then they will not use it. And so
correct.
You cannot You cannot look at this and say, oh, well, this, at least they're not looking at race anymore. No, they're engineering a process that will give them the same outcome as race.
Two things. One, I think it's hilarious that Asians have become a footnote in this whole discussion. It's just like whites footnote and Asians. And two, William, I think the purpose of doing what you're pointing out is what Daniel is saying as the end point is, to tip the scales for that agenda, for tip the scales for that kind of culture is what they want. And I honestly think it leads perfectly into the next story, because I think the next story connects to it 100%.
Because this is the culture you will get. Bill Nye made headlines this week when he said the F word. Yes, Bill Nye took to YouTube and other places to essentially tell people that the world is on effing fire. he said this to viewers, "Grow the F up. You're not children anymore. I didn't mind explaining photosynthesis to you when you were 12, but you're adults now." So Bill Nye the Science Guy, if you're unfamiliar, hosted a very popular science show while millennials were growing up, and now he's talking to those grown-up millennials, essentially saying that the world is on fire and that global warming is a catastrophe, and that Gen Xers and millennials who were weaned on Nye's brand of wacky pedagogy have to step up and actually do something about it. So he's decided that he should use the F word. What does he want done about it? Well, of course, he endorsed the Green New Deal, and he thinks putting a price on carbon overall is a good idea. He thinks essentially curtailing fossil fuel usage is the right way to go. And so he has endorsed Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's trademark legislation. People are taking to this and essentially showing Bill Nye all the love in the world. People on Twitter, of course, were saying, you know, Bill Nye was the guy when we were growing up and now he's swearing. Isn't that so cool? It was John Oliver said, I think we broke Bill Nye, which I think was kind of a funny remark, although not really. So Justin, Bill Nye, the science guy, has gone full woke. What say you?
Isn't this the same guy who said that science proved Tom Brady deflated footballs?
Yes.
I mean, doesn't that say everything you need to know? I mean, look.
It does, but why don't you unpack that for the viewer who doesn't quite think in the level of abstraction you do?
Wait, are there cameras in here? There are viewers?
Whatever, listeners. I'm thinking about the next story, viewers.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I didn't have to put clothes back on. Just wanted to make sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, look. Here's the thing, right? Is it cool that Bill Nye swore? Yeah, fine. Everyone can swear. That's fine. I think it's funny. I mean, he actually said the same
everyone
thing.
But
wake
Daniel.
The fuck up. Yeah, everyone but Daniel. We don't want Daniel to get fired. But, no, it's like he said the wake the fuck up thing Zack Snyder said, right? And this is the world we're living in now, where we've got two sides screaming at each other for the other one to wake the fuck up, which is ironic that the side that's living in a dream world is literally screaming the wake the fuck up as well. But you even see that within the Snyder movement, where there are people on opposite sides arguing that Snyder supports both sides. It's just fucking insane. Because of the insane world people like Bill Nye live in and have been raised in. Look, John Oliver, his comment, Daniel, was incredibly insidious. We broke Bill Nye. That implies that Bill Nye is correct. And Bill Nye has such moral superiority to us that us not listening to him has made him turn into an asshole when he really isn't one. And that's John Oliver's entire stick, right? He puts himself on a pedestal and acts like he's justified in being like that because he's superior to us. It's the philosopher king's mentality. This is what Bill Nye is. This is what our teachers have been. This is what you were talking about with the education system, Daniel. They believe, step on any college campus, and they will tell you about Plato and the allegory of the cave. And they will tell you all about it and how that's the foundation of all knowledge. And that's what this is. They all believe that they are the philosopher kings. We put people into the education system as teachers who believed that not only did they know better about their expertise, but they knew better about the world, and that they raised us to be what they wanted. And because we're taking the knowledge that they gave us and we're acting differently than that, they're getting sanctimonious about it because only they can truly understand the world. We only just see shadows on the cave. They actually see the light. They actually see the world. We only see the shadows the light casts on the wall. So who are we to go against what Bill Nye says? Bill Nye can really see the world. We just see the shadows. And that's what this is all about. He's getting like this because, oh, he understands Tom Brady really deflated footballs. We don't understand the way it really works. We don't understand the way the world really works. And this is the point the left is at. This is the point the education system is at. They convinced us. I know they did it when I was a kid. They convinced us that education, teaching is only for a certain type of person. It's only for a certain type of person. And that was code for leftists. Only leftists knew how to teach. Only leftists had business getting involved with education. And it was the same thing with English and writing. And we see this with things like, you know, all these science fiction awards. Only leftists knew how to write. Only leftists knew how to read. The humanities are the worst of all with this. With science, you still had to have some sort of a connection to reality, it seemed. But now Bill Nye, the guy who was on TV seemingly teaching innocuous truths, is doing this too. This is a prime example of the degradation of our culture and the degradation of the government-run education system. Is that enough for you, Daniel, of an unpacking?
My God. My heart goes pitter-patter. That's all phenomenal. Just package that, and we'll just put that out on repeat over a loudspeaker into the world.
Tom Brady is a golden god. The end.
William, the shadows on the cave must have been cast by the flaming globe that Bill Nye set on fire in this video, exclaiming that the Earth is on fire, therefore we should destroy our entire fossil fuel-based economy. Are you convinced now?
Well, you know, everyone took that quote, but there was a quote later in the video that that no one really listened to. It was this.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am not a genius.
Yeah, that was he actually said that.
That's the drop. Is this because Midsider Kevin put this on Twitter that we're now using it forever?
I had actually already cut it, but it was popular. But that was actually Bill Nye. Now, what I want to say about Bill Nye, first of all, he's not a scientist. But
his name is the science guy.
Well, it's even worse. So you'd think that's ad hominem, but in this case, it's actually not, because I want to make a totally different argument. He's a communicator, and he's supposed to be communicating about science. And I have read many a scientific paper, and none of them had an argument that said, wake the fuck up. That's not how you make a scientific argument. And it's not even how you rhetorically would convince someone who doesn't think that you're right, that you have new knowledge for them to consider. That's not even a proper rhetorical way to make the argument. So
right, it's pandering to the people who already agree with you. I mean, Zack Snyder said it, wake the fuck up, in a room full of people who already agreed with him, and that's why it worked. It doesn't work with the people who are against you.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a not only example of bad science, but bad communicating. So, yeah, wake the fuck up, Bill Nye. That's not how you argue or communicate.
I think it's worse than bad. And this piggybacks only 90% off of what Justin was saying, which is that
unacceptable.
It's beyond bad communicating. It's beyond bad science. It's outright evil, in the sense that essentially what he's setting up is the consequence of this, right? Which is, if you don't wake the F up, then we're going to force you to do it. Because the science is settled, and we're past the point of science. And that's sort of the metaphor of Bill Nye lighting a globe on fire and using the F word, right? That's kind of the metaphor the video is going, is we're past science now. The science is done. We've done that. We're moving on. Now we're to the point where we're just going to beat you over the head and say, you must do this because we're right and you're wrong. That's what I think is particularly insidious about this Bill Nye video, in what it implies culturally, what it implies philosophically. It's, we're done. We don't have to talk about this anymore. We don't have to have a discussion anymore. You're just wrong. Wake the F up.
That's our entire culture now, Daniel, and that's why Trump is such a tragedy, is he took that rhetorical tactic that the left has, you know, raised us on. As you know, as my whole rant I just went on about, you know, that's what the left raised us on, that everything they say is right. They're the philosopher kings, that we don't have to debate it anymore. And he gave the right that perspective as well. And now our entire culture is just both sides yelling at each other about how the debate's over.
Yeah, hooray. Oh, that's a great cultural sandwich right there. Taste it. So, I said earlier that you were all viewers, and that was because I was foreshadowing this story in hoping that we were a video podcast, at least for this week, but we're not, so you'll have to look it up yourself. Emily Ratajkowski, is that how you say that, Justin?
I have no idea. Just because it ends in a ski, you think I know how to say it? You fucking racist.
You're the resident expert about all things ski. Has posed naked to decry the, quote, 25 old white men who voted to ban abortion in Alabama, as Kylie Jenner and Rihanna also share outrage. So, Emily Ratajkowski, let it be known that she is not pleased with the recent Alabama law prohibiting abortions. The 27-year-old actress posed naked for a photo shared on Instagram where she decried HB 314, a comprehensive bill, essentially banning abortion even in the event of rape or incest. Emily kept her arm over her chest and positioned a pink flower in a place where you might expect a pink flower to go in this daring photo posted on Tuesday morning. She said, quote, "These men in power are imposing their wills onto the bodies of women in order to uphold the patriarchy and perpetuate the industrial prison complex by preventing women of low economic opportunity the rights to choose to not reproduce. The states trying to ban abortion are the states that have the highest proportions of black women living there. This is about class and race and is a direct attack on the fundamental human rights women in the U.S. deserve and are protected by under Roe v. Wade, our bodies, our choice." She posed in the nude against a stark white backdrop, seemingly only wearing eyeliner and mascara. And of course, this changed everyone's mind, and we've overturned the laws, and we've now moved on with our lives because, of course, a woman in a near-naked state would do that. So, Justin, before we get into the abortion argument...
I'm not interested in the abortion argument. What? I'm interested in the cultural argument surrounding the abortion argument.
What the hell is this supposed to accomplish? What does posing nude accomplish? Does it just raise awareness?
I mean, it raises something, and I don't know if we want to call it awareness.
I lobbed that one up.
Yeah, that was easy. That was like some metaphor about a good Tom Brady throw that I can't complete right now because I'm not Tom Brady, so I can't complete it. Look, first of all, a woman posting half naked on Instagram is like the Jets losing. Like, you don't need
water
to, like, report on it. Oh, no, a woman posts half naked on Instagram. That's the other thing. It's like, oh, no, they passed an abortion law. Don't pose half naked. No, stop. Put your clothes back on. This is my question. How many states do we need to get to ban abortion before all women are just walking around naked all the time? Because tell me that
bad
number and I will make
this
happen. Let's make the patriarchy such a thing that women have to rebel by being naked at all times. Can we make that happen? Can we do that?
Reductio ad justiciarum.
That's right. That's right. But no, here's a question I have for you, Daniel. This seems to be a case of globalism gone crazy, which makes us forget federalism. And what I mean by that is, and maybe my definition of federalism is incorrect, and you can correct me, but I'm pretty sure it's correct. One of the wonderful things...
Just kidding.
Okay. One of the wonderful things about the U.S. is that there are 50 states that can have 50 different cultures and 50 different sets of laws. And you can look at all 50 and you can say, which is the one that is most similar to the world I want to live in? And you can live there now. But we now live in a world because of social media and because communication technology is so good that we can now know what's going on in every state and get mad about every state not being exactly the state we want to live in. Why are people so narcissistic that they think every state in the union has to be the world they would want to live in? Why can't there be live and let live? You know, obviously I'm not advocating like you go to one state where... I'm not advocating a Sliders universe, right? That's a deep reference there. I'm not advocating like you go to one universe where like you can just kill anyone no matter what. I'm not saying, you know, there's... You go to Arkansas and like all murder is legal. Like there's the Purge state, right? There's the Purge planet like in Rick and Morty. I'm not advocating that, but within the general guideline of the Constitution, you then have 50 different variances. Isn't that what this country was founded upon? And doesn't that make for a better world where there everyone has the opportunity, the mobility, and the economic ability to save and move to these different places?
Your federalism concept is without flaw.
Yes.
I would say that the founders thought the states would be, I forget whose exact quote, maybe Jefferson or Madison, but quote, laboratories of democracy. The idea being that states would compete about who can protect more rights, basically, of their citizens, or to put it differently, protect rights better for their citizens. We've seen over the years that is somewhat true and somewhat not true, in the sense that it's been corrupted in many ways by the federal government's takeover of certain state issues. It was fundamentally changed post-Civil War with the 14th Amendment, which incorporated many of the rights in the Constitution against the states. A lot of people don't know that before the 14th Amendment, the Constitution basically did not apply to the states, period. States had their own constitutions. And it was post-Civil War when we started to think about things like the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, applying against the states. So federalism is very different now than what it was at the founding. And I think there's some good in that and some bad. William, I think what I want to ask you is this the kind of thing that should be a federalism issue, or is this the kind of thing more like freedom of speech that should be a national issue?
Oh man, I think that's a hard question. I think that there's an aspect of it that should be a federal thing, and an aspect of it that should be a state thing. But it's. I think this comes back to Roe versus Wade being a shaky argument for why someone should be able to at any point receive an abortion. I mean, it's sort of argued from an idea of privacy and not the argument that is given, which is barely the argument ever given, almost as a footnote here. If you remember, the argument was all about race. And then at the end, oh, by the way, I own my body. Boy, would it be nice if they made that the argument from the beginning, right? That, hey, I own my body, so I can do with it what I want. That if that was the argument in Roe laid out in Roe versus Wade, that'd be very different. I don't know. I don't know that I have a good answer for that. But I think that, again, this comes back to what we were talking about in the last article with how you make an argument. So apparently we shouldn't like this because a bunch of white men did it. Was there any Latina on the Supreme Court when Roe versus Wade was decided? Daniel, could you look that up?
There was definitely no Latinx.
Let me think about it. No.
There wasn't?
No, there wasn't.
Also, the governor of Alabama, old white man, right?
Well, that might be how she identifies, but I don't know.
Oh, no. So, in other words, that first argument, not really based in reality.
Yeah.
And there's a couple things, you know, I've been listening to the Spectrum, because this news is all over the place right now. The virtue signaling is at an all-time
peak. Wait, why
do
autistic people know more about this?
No, Justin. Spectrum has different meanings.
Yeah, I've been listening to all across the political spectrum. And and you know, Shapiro made a couple good points. Is it automatic? This is another question for our legal scholar, Daniel T. Richards. Is it automatic now that they've passed this law that Roe versus Wade is going to be overturned? It's just like automatic, right? Like they pass a law and now there's just going to, you know, maybe in a couple weeks we'll have a case up at the Supreme Court and they're just going to overturn it, right?
It's not really how any of that works. No.
Yeah. I think that before you give that answer, also, is it also true that every country in the modern Western world allows abortion all the way until well into the third trimester?
Yeah. Again, no.
Oh, so you're saying that this is a problem everyone is struggling with right now across the Western world?
This is the answer that I hate that objectivists give, But this is one of the issues for me which solidly falls into this camp without any second thought about it, which is this issue is hard. It's hard. And I look, I'm
It's a weird thing to get hard about.
Gross.
Yeah, you're saying fundamentally, hard, and there's a naked picture of a woman on my screen right now, so.
Yeah, but what does it matter to you?
William's like, it doesn't work that way. You don't get hard when there's a naked picture
exactly.
of a woman.
I mean, it's beautiful, but it's not.
I would argue that picture is not beautiful or arousing, but continue.
It's none of those things. So I'm fundamentally pro-choice, but it's not as if... This is what I don't get sometimes about the objectivist argument here, which is that it relies a lot on this concept of, like, these are people who just want to go out and control other people's lives and their bodies. And if that's not the objectivist argument, sometimes it's the sort of standard... left argument. But look, I know many people who are anti-abortion, and many of them are libertarian in almost every other way. But they have this fundamental belief, albeit wrong, in my opinion, and grossly wrong, in my opinion, that life begins at conception. And they try to be consistent with that belief. They try their best to have a principle around that belief that I believe is incorrect. But they're not doing it out of some malice. They're not doing it out of this idea that I want to control women. They're doing it out of this idea that they think that what's going on right now is another Holocaust. And I think they're wrong about that. And I think if they genuinely believed it, they'd be doing more than they are. But my point being that it's a difficult issue that doesn't just require screaming at each other from either sides, and is going to require, dare I say it, in this political federal republic that we have, a compromise. Yes, it is going to require a compromise. Otherwise, we're never going to live through this. It's just going to be constant fighting. I have one other thing to say, Justin, unless you have a response to that.
Well, I'm going to build on it a little bit. I mean, I agree with everything you're saying about compromise, but it comes back to what I think it all comes back to, and what it ultimately is going to require, is the personal responsibility that comes along with individualism. To give the best interpretation of the perspective you're talking about, of the people who are saying, you know, life begins at conception and therefore all abortion is wrong, the best perspective on that is what they're basically saying is they don't want abortions to be handed out for anyone who just makes a mistake. Or they decide, oh, I don't want to use contraception tonight. And then, oh, now I'm going to have an abortion because of what happened to it. It can't be a flippant decision. And this may seem crazy to people, but to me, this is the same thing as being straight edge. The number one thing I hate about alcohol in this country, maybe it's across the world, I don't know, but I can only talk as an American, is the way people treat it so flippantly. I would never tell you it should be illegal for you to drink alcohol. I would never do that. But I think drinking alcohol is bad. I think you're literally pouring a toxic chemical into your body. I think it's a drug. And I think it's the same thing as taking a hard drug. And I think it's socially acceptable. But people treat it so flippantly, like it's just a normal decision. Like, oh, I get home every day and I drink alcohol. Or, oh, it's the weekend, now I get shit-faced. But we don't talk about the personal responsibility of that. And they want the personal responsibility to be put back into sex because they see life starting as conception. So they see the consequences of abortion as even more harmful than the consequences of drinking. Whether you agree with them or not, that is the benevolent perspective that they're taking. Now, again, I don't believe in saying abortion should be outlawed because I don't believe in telling you you shouldn't, what you can and can't do with your body, right? But that is the argument. And this all comes down to personal responsibility. If it is legal, let's say hypothetically it all gets legal. It all gets legalized. You still need to take it seriously as a choice. It's not just like you can go to Target and buy a beer so you drink it. It's not just marijuana is legal so you smoke it now. This is a complicated procedure medically, morally, psychologically. The consequences are longstanding, and no one talks about that on either side. On the one side, they're not talking even about the consequences of the woman who has the abortion. They're just talking about it, the consequences on the unborn life, right? Daniel, you said they're saying life because of conception. Right. So they're forwarding that. But even on the other side, we have all these women who are on Twitter now saying, I had this abortion and this is what was better, blah, blah, blah. And then they go, well, this is better for me and for the kid. And from that perspective, that doesn't make any sense either, because that's not looking at the perspective of the potential life. So the compromise has to be personal responsibility and learning the consequences. Because again, going back to the first two stories, we're now living in a society where we don't want to deal with the consequences because we don't believe we have to, because these philosopher kings have told us they understand the consequences better and our responsibility is just to do what we're told.
Is this the philosopher kings edition? Very timely.
I mean, it was the adversity score edition is what I was saying, but
maybe we should use an adversity score to determine whether you should have an abortion.
Oh,
what's the kid's potential future adversity score? If the score is above 50, then you can't have an abortion because we need more diversity. And then if it's below 50, you're forced to have an abortion because we need more diversity.
William Green's platform right here, folks.
The sad part is I think he just got like 50 voters. I think he just got 50 supporters.
Before we lose the entirety of our pro-choice audience, I will say that I do believe what Alabama is doing is a fundamental violation of the individual rights of women. I think that while a compromise is probably going to be required in order to have this issue, quote unquote, settled in any significant way, this is way extreme in terms of the violation of rights.
Why don't we live in pretend land for a second? Talk about what a compromise might look like. You know, there are tons of families that would love to have children, and giving people a low cost, low friction way to instead of having abortion, give those children up for adoption. How much
that would be part of a compromise?
Yeah, because again, if the metric we're trying to measure here is we want less abortions, then that would certainly be one way to do it. The other is
fewer.
If you look on the other side of the coin here, all the arguments that they make, they sometimes make the my body, my choice argument, which at least I can get behind. Hey, self-ownership. But that doesn't address the argument from the other side saying that this is a life, right? But if you say, hey, we're going to compromise here, like people are going to have abortions, but we want less abortions, not more abortions, right? We want to give people more options. We want them to use contraceptives. We want them to engage in safe sex. We want them to responsibly deal with the fact that if they do get pregnant, what to do with it. Let's make some charities. Let's get this adoption train going. Let's do all these sorts of things. Let's look at the metric here of the number of abortions and solve for X. Instead of each side calling the other evil.
Yes, well, that is going to be difficult. My prediction is that some law about abortion goes to the Supreme Court, and either Roberts or Kavanaugh or a combination of the two sides with the left, and Roe v. Wade is sustained in some meaningful way. That is my prediction. As far as predictions go, please note that I said there was exactly a 0% chance that Donald Trump is ever elected president, so keep that in mind. There also seems to be a 0% chance that this fan base petition to remake the Game of Thrones Season 8 will ever come to fruition. Nonetheless, 500,000 people now
would
not have
now
signed this change.org petition to have writers David Benioff and D.B. Weiss ejected from the show, have it rewritten and made into something that isn't total crap. Now, I don't watch Game of Thrones at all. I'm not one of those people who constantly talks about it, although it's come up more lately because people constantly ask me what I thought of the episode and I have to tell them to go away. But this reminds me of so many of these fan-based petitions that just are never going to go anywhere. And my question to you, Justin, is in the current culture of fandom and how fans consume media, will anyone ever be happy with an ending ever again?
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, it's up to 1 million people have signed this petition now.
Oh, breaking news.
Yeah, breaking news. The second thing is, in answer to your question, will anyone ever be happy with an ending again? I mean, the issue is more people don't know how to end things. I mean, it's a response to a valid cultural problem, but it's an invalid response. if that makes sense. The idea of like, oh, let's start a petition and try to get the whole thing rewritten doesn't make any sense. That's never going to happen. It just makes you seem whiny and entitled. But there is a valid thing. I mean, off the top of your head, Daniel, how many endings of a TV show or even a movie can you name that have been worthwhile?
Breaking Bad.
Off the top of my head, House.
Breaking Bad.
So we've named two. Okay.
Breaking Bad.
Avatar: The Last Airbender TV show.
The movie was trash,
not the movie.
But that. I mean,
I agree with those two.
But
name another one. Name another one besides those two.
It'd be under eight out of all the shows I've ever watched.
Eight. I love how you picked the number eight. Why the number eight?
4, 8, 15, 16, 20.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah, so yeah, I agree, right? Off the top of my head, I can pretty much only name House and name Breaking Bad. And maybe Deep Space Nine, William?
Yeah.
I don't remember the ending being particularly bad. I remember it being pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe three. Boy Meets World was pretty good, too. Right, so that's going back to Babylon 5, sort of,
if you take out the last season.
Right, well, so, I mean, same thing. You take out the last season of Lost, and that ending was fine, too. If you get rid of season six, we can start playing these games, though. But the point is, there's a number of reasons that these shows don't know how to end. I mean, the first is the TV syndication model and the TV production model, where they... TV writing traditionally had to figure out how to perpetuate these shows longer than they needed to go on. So the idea of having limited narratives that have an endpoint was never there before. So when they had to end them, it was just sort of like, okay, now we have to figure out how to end this. So there was no writing for thematic cohesion. But then there's also the advent of naturalism, which makes it so you're not telling a story that has any sort of thematic integration. You're just talking about how shitty people's lives are, so of course things are going to end terribly. I mean, I don't want to talk specifically about Game of Thrones because, per Daniel's suggestion, we're going to be doing a Patreon exclusive episode this week about the ending of Game of Thrones. The finale is tonight. We're recording this on Sunday, so the finale is tonight. We're going to do a Patreon exclusive episode. I know William is going to have a lot to say. I watched those two videos, William, you sent me about the writing. There's some interesting stuff in there. There's some stuff I disagree with. So in that, in specific, I don't want to talk about. What I want to talk about is exactly what you're saying, Daniel, this cultural thing from one standpoint where we don't know how to write. We don't know how to tell stories anymore. And then from the other side, the fans and their entitlement. It blows my mind, Daniel, that Game of Thrones has a million signatures when the Zack Snyder petition for releasing the Snyder Cut of Justice League only got 180,000. Because all of this makes all of the fans look bad. It makes all fandom look bad because nobody has any perspective on what to get upset about and what not to get upset about. Dear Game of Thrones fans, I'm sorry your show is ending shittily like everyone else's shows have ended. What did you expect to happen? I mean, this is like the Walking Dead fans getting mad. Like, everyone knew that show was going to end terribly years ago. I haven't even watched the latest season because of it. And that's what you get upset about? Whereas what happened in the production of Justice League was more of an injustice. And then, but even within that, there are people in there within the movement of the release the Snyder Cut movement out there. They're more interested in boycotting WB. And now they've turned towards AT&T because AT&T owns WB. They want to boycott these companies. Boycott? This is an injustice that you need to boycott? You think they don't deserve to be in business? Remember back in the day where Star Trek got canceled and they wrote a letter writing campaign to say, hey, we would like this show to still be on? Why these fans, they're incredibly entitled, and they're entitled about everything, Daniel. I mean, William, do you have an answer to that?
Yeah, I do. I want to sort of stand up for fans for a second. I think they are entitled to something. They are entitled to proper endings. They are entitled to good writing, right? Like, these are things they're entitled to. I mean, we're entitled to, you know, George R.R. Martin finishing his books. He put the first few out there, right? He had a narrative arc. He made a promise that these books would exist. Now, I'm not saying that, like, this is some sort of, like, slavery sort of thing where we should lock him up until he finishes. What I'm saying is he made a promise to the folks who read the first book of the Song of Ice and Fire, that he was going to take us somewhere, right? Like, this was going to be a set of a certain number, and that they would be completed eventually, right? And same thing with this show. With the show, when we started the show, it's like, hey, this is going somewhere. And when it ends up not going that place, or ends up completely changing in the last two seasons, I would argue for sure the last two seasons, probably starting in season six, when something fundamentally changed, they are entitled in a sense, right? Like, they've been investing their emotions and their money into something that is not delivering on its promise. And so in that sense, I'm okay with feeling entitled in that case. What I'm not okay with is feeling entitled, so now I'm going to go after... It's misplaced to put that feeling on, like in the example you gave, like on AT&T, boycotting AT&T. No, what we should be doing is doing what we're doing in our Patreon-only episode of Game of Thrones, breaking it down, analyzing it, appreciating the parts that are good, pointing out the parts that are bad, and encouraging future writers to address those things and to think about those things as they're coming out with stories, and to find good writers and good creators like Snyder and support them when we can.
I agree with all of your endpoint. All of that you just said at the end is great. My question for Daniel is, I compare this to sports. And what I mean by that is, if you buy a ticket, you're not entitled for your team to win. You should have them give the best effort. You're entitled to seeing your coach and your players give the
best
effort.
You're going to ask Daniel
possible.
That when you have a Lions fan right here?
No.
Oh my God. Talk about
terrible
interviewing.
I'm trying to involve Daniel in the conversation. It's not
an interview. People were
you
so
can
much
respond
fans
in while you want.
Of the Lions as just being adjacent to the team, the Lions.
No, this is the point I'm making. I don't think you're entitled to a good ending. I think you're entitled to the writers doing what they said they're going to do, which is the best job possible. They weren't paying, right? When you're watching Game of Thrones and you're buying the merchandise and you're buying HBO to see Game of Thrones, you're not paying for George R.R. Martin. You're paying for these two guys, Benioff and what's his name? What are their names?
Weiss.
D.B.
Dumb
Weiss.
And Dumber.
I was going to say Weiss. Yeah, Weiss and Benioff. You're paying for them. And when you sit down to watch the show, you're assuming they're going to give their best effort. That's what you're entitled
but
to.
But they're not their giving effort, their best maybe, effort. They are not giving their best effort. They
how
are
do you
moved
know
on
that?
Because they've moved on to Star Wars. They,
how do you know that?
Because if we really want to get into this, because HBO said, give me 10 episodes. They said no, because they wanted 10 seasons originally. They said no to that. Then they said, well, for season 8, give us 10 episodes. They said, no, we're only going to do 5 or 4 or what, 6, whatever it's at. They are done with the series. They've said that. They've said they're done. They don't want to work on this anymore.
See, okay, now I feel like I'm arguing Daniel's perspective of not psychologizing, but I don't know how you know that. Maybe they legitimately thought they only needed 8 episodes to wrap it up. If you can empirically prove to me that they were done because they wanted to do Star Wars, if you can release a quote, if you can find a quote and release it that says, fuck Game of Thrones, I'm moving on to Star Wars, then I'm with you 100%. They
all
did
right.
not give their best
Come
effort.
Come to our Patreon-only episode where I will lay that argument out. It's been laid out by others, Doomcock and Nerdrotic, but yeah.
Okay, if you can prove it, I'm with you if you can prove it.
I mean, you're not
going
to find a quote of them exactly saying those words because they're not going to do that until after the show is done, right? They're not going to come out and berate the fans quite like that.
Daniel, help me out here.
Well, okay. I'll take a slightly different path here and just refuse to use the word entitled to. I don't think you're entitled to anything of a creator. You know, that word is strange to me in this context because there could be some moral weight to it, but honestly, it, to me, just falls in this weird legal realm and I don't like it. It's icky. You're not entitled. You know, the show's creators, what you hope for is that the show's creators have this moral upstandingness where they are going to create what they consider to be, what they as artists consider to be a good show, and then present it. And that's it. But you're not entitled to the show ending in any particular way. You're not entitled to the show ending in a particularly good way that you see it. And that's the thing here is there's good in context of does it fulfill, the art? Does it fulfill what the art is supposed to do, what the art intended, what the art, quote-unquote, foreshadowed, to use a word? Or does it fail at that? And then two, do you enjoy it? Is there, what is your experience of this thing? And I feel like too many fans now forego the first analysis entirely and go entirely toward, I'm entitled to a show that makes me have feels.
Yeah, it's emotionalism as fandom.
And I don't know how we overcome that in the current culture. I think that's why I sort of posited that question to you, Justin. Will any fan ever be happy with an ending ever again? I think the answer is basically no. And yes, it's partially because I agree with you that many shows have objectively bad endings based on the universe and plot and theme that they have created. But it's also because fans want their show. They want their ending. And they're never going to have their ending.
Yeah, I think that's an oversimplification. They certainly are. I think like all things on the midside, it's a false dichotomy. False dichotomy, bro. There are fans that want their ending, right? But those fans are used as straw man against this more sophisticated argument for romanticism, right? There are tons of folks that are analyzing Game of Thrones. I mentioned a few already that are looking at it implicitly through that romantic lens and saying like, hey, we were going somewhere. We were doing subversion in a more romantic way. And now we're just doing things in the last two seasons in the name of subversion, which are wrecking the theme and everything, like not doing the payoffs that you would expect. But it's not that they want plot elements to change. They're not saying,
look,
we don't want plot elements. They're saying, hey, be consistent with the product you've been giving us all along.
But here's the thing. I don't watch Game of Thrones. I can't speak to the specific plot elements. But I you know, in what I know about George R. R. Martin and his writing and how he deals with characters, I don't expect how anyone saw this going any differently from the beginning. You cannot have a show with basically infinity number characters and have those characters have any development whatsoever over a given period of time. He's basically using characters as a device to not have to write plot and theme, ultimately. And so I don't know from the beginning how people could think this could go any other way. I'm sorry, which is why I'm not investing in the show. I refuse.
Well, and also, I don't know how people could be looking at Game of Thrones through a romantic lens. I mean, not to spoil the Patreon-exclusive episode, but have you not been watching the show that I've been watching this whole time?
I mean, like, I gave it four episodes, and I thought, this is just naturalistic garbage that's just about dying and sex, and I don't care. If I want to watch dying and sex, there's The News.
Yeah, I mean, I think that puts a point on it, and that leads into our...
Sorry, William, I still love you.
Our Patreon-exclusive episode, and we'll go into that more specifically on the Patreon-exclusive episode, sans Daniel, because you just got... That was Daniel's entire take on the Patreon-exclusive episode, so there you go. You got some of Patreon for
just
free.
Drop that in.
Yeah.
Be like,
but I do think the broader point here is about what Daniel was saying about art, and, you know, it's not the entitlement, and what I'm trying to say is it's a product. And what you're paying for is them giving the best possible product they believe they can make. And the argument has to become about, are they actually doing that in good faith or not? And if they're not doing it in good faith or not, maybe there's an argument there's fraud. But then that's between the employer and the... I'm not saying it's legally fraud, but...
Stop using these words.
Sorry, I'll stop using the legal words. Daniel's got like a legal brain now. I need to remember that.
Yeah.
I mean,
just say dishonesty. Look, it's just dishonesty.
Perfect. Right. It's dishonesty. And that's between the employer and the company, right? That's HBO needs to come to terms with that they were dealing with dishonest people. Who within HBO hired people that were so dishonest they could just quit on a show with the last season? Like, how you're fucking terrible. You're a writer and that's what you're doing. Why would Star Wars hire them? Why would Kathleen Kennedy and Disney hire them if they're that dishonest? I mean, let's not go into the whole Disney thing. We know why they would hire them, but that's the thing. Like, that's not, I've run out of steam. Can we just
the hopeful romantic with JML?
Just cue the music. Wasn't focused on. As always, if you'd like to participate in these conversations during the week, you can join our Discord channel. Just go to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast, and you can click on any episode, and there's a link to joining our Discord server, and you can become part of these conversations and influence these conversations. And maybe I will even invite you on to Patreon exclusive episodes. There is precedent for that as well. This week for the review, I'd like to talk about Cobra Kai Season 2. I don't want to spoil it, first of all, because William hasn't seen it yet, but also because I don't want to ruin the joy of watching the show for you all. I remember when we talked about this in Show or Takedown, we thought it was going to look terrible. We said, why did we need this? And then Season 1, I was blown away by. And Season 2,
were
I was...
wrong. We were so wrong. I'm so happy.
And that's
so
the thing.
Wrong.
That's one of those things, right? Prove me wrong. I want to be proven wrong. And this show has done it again. I was worried at the end of the first season because they did the whole thing about mercy, no mercy, and it seemed they were saying Cobra Kai was wrong. But to not spoil specific plot points, but to go on sort of the thematic approach of this season, the whole first season was about how masculinity and alphaness was needed. Because, you know, the 80s was about how terrible alphas are, and that raised us on this idea that men should be these beta, you know, pussies, basically. And I say that word because that word's used over and over again in the show.
I'm triggered as a woman.
Oh, sorry. So they say that over and over again in the show. So the whole first season is about that. But then season two is about, when does that go too far? When is that too far? And this is concretized by bringing back John Kreese, the guy who originally founded Cobra Kai. And he's sort of trying to take over Cobra Kai again. Now, again, that's as far as I'm going to go with it. But Cobra Kai's mantra is strike first, strike hard, no mercy. And really what the show is talking about now is the no mercy part of it. We've taken strike first and strike hard as good. Those are considered to be good things. And they continually show that throughout the show. Like, there's an episode about dating and love, which is just a phenomenal episode. I mean, if you've ever wanted to see Johnny Lawrence try and use Tinder, it was fucking entertaining as hell. A great episode. Those are taken as for granted. But what does no mercy mean? And is mercy a good thing? When is it a bad thing? When should it be used? What does it say about your character if you have no mercy? And what happens if you take the old Cobra Kai mentality? What basically happens if you take the old Cobra Kai mentality, the straw man of alphaness and maleness, masculinity that was propped up in the 80s, and you live by that? What happens to you? And was Johnny Lawrence really living like that? That's what the whole season is about. And they also go into sort of the lack of reality of it because, you know, one of the slogans also is Cobra Kai never dies. And there's a whole episode about the idea that saying nothing, you know, Cobra Kai never dies is that's anti-reality. And what are the consequences of that? And how does that lead into the no mercy? And the best way I can sum up this show and why you should watch it is, I was reading what the producers were saying about season two after it was over and season three. And they said something that was basically romantic realism, which is, we know was Ayn Rand's approach to writing and art. And they said that, you know, this is a heightened version of reality. We are telling a heightened version of reality, but we needed to make sure that there were real consequences of it. And when I read that, I was like, they are taking everything that was great about 80s Hollywood. 80s Hollywood was, you know, sort of pulp romanticism, this idea that it's a heightened reality. But it became so disconnected from reality that there were no real consequences in these stories and everything. You know, what's part of what makes Die Hard the greatest action movie of all time is there are those real consequences, and it's a heightened version of reality. But based upon that, there are real consequences on John McClane and his life and his relationship with his family and everyone involved in that situation. That became lost. And that is what happened with how we transitioned into naturalism. Now this show is going back to the heightened reality, but bringing in the consequences. And it's created a wonderful story about the way ideas and the way we live our lives shape our lives and our experiences and who we are. I mean, to sum this up, Johnny Lawrence even says that. He goes, I'm not just teaching you karate, I'm teaching you how to live. And the fact that Johnny Lawrence is trying to strive for an integrated life like that, I think that's missing from our culture in general, and it's definitely missing from our art. So it's crazy that somehow YouTube, this platform that's censoring everyone left and right, and it, yeah, I don't know, are they censoring people on the left? Mainly people on the right.
Mainly the right. Yeah, I think
yeah,
right.
But you know what I meant. I meant all over the place. They're just censoring people, like, you know, the phrase. It's crazy that they have, first of all, it's a streaming show, and that it's YouTube that has one of the best shows, if not the best show, on right now. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Daniel, did you ever watch season one?
No.
Are you going to now?
I don't know. Maybe, you know, that this sounds more interesting to me than the first season. So, I was never a big Karate Kid fan overall. So I don't have this interest in the nostalgia portion of this.
To be honest with you, I was never a big Karate Kid fan either because of the approach it had. I mean, I never really liked Daniel. And that's part of the reason I like the Daniel LaRusso. Somebody's going to take that drop now. That drop is
someone.
Fucked. Insider Kevin and William over here are going to take that drop of I never really liked Daniel. No, I never really liked Daniel LaRusso. And this show, like, he's a fucking dickhead. I fucking hate him so much. And you're supposed to. You're supposed to see. I mean, he nearly destroys his marriage. It's hilarious. So I think that you don't have to be a Karate Kid fan. I think you just have to understand the 80s and 80s art and have seen the movie and you'll get it.
Yeah. Certainly season two sounds more interesting to me than season one. So there's some potential.
Yeah, I think you can't have season two without season one, though, Daniel. So to be fair,
well, I'm not going to dive into season two.
Yeah, I was going to say, you need to see the setup for this payoff.
Speaking of seeing the setup, every week we always discuss trailers on this show, and I post Trailer Takedown on Saturday at some time. I try to post it in the morning, but it'll always be up on Saturday. If you want to see it, you just go to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast. You can watch it before the episode, after the episode, or during the episode. You can alternate between watching a trailer and listening to our takes on it.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Always Be My Maybe is a Netflix romantic comedy, and I don't really like to use Netflix trailers on here, although this is one of those that's all it says in select theaters at the end. So Netflix is trying to cross over to, I think, for awards purposes. They're trying to have some in theaters that are also released on Netflix. But I really wanted to talk about this because they're very clearly trying to hop on the Crazy Rich Asians bandwagon. It's an all Asian cast. I mean, it's an all-Asian to the Caucasian. It's an all-Asian cast
all
to the point
Cajun
that they
cast.
Actually,
that would be way better.
Does sound better. I'd watch that one. I'd definitely watch that one. That's Gambit, right? Gambit should be an all-Cajun cast if they ever make that movie.
Oh, yeah.
I'm having a hard time speaking right now because I have a retainer. I don't know if you guys hear my subtle lisp. So, no, they're jumping on the Crazy Rich Asians bandwagon. I'm having an all-Asian cast. And it's to the point that they've even finally in Hollywood acknowledged that Keanu Reeves is an Asian, that he's in this trailer. So I just think from a cultural standpoint, this is interesting. This stars Ali Wong, who's a stand-up comedian, and Randall Park, who's known for playing Kim Jong, was it Un or Il in that movie, The Dictator?
One of them.
He's also the father in, I can't remember the show name now. The Asian sitcom.
Fresh off the boat.
And what it is Ali Wong plays a celebrity chef. She's dating Daniel Day Kim, who, Daniel, who did he play?
He played Sun. Boat!
Sun was the woman, but yes, he played Sun's husband, Jin, on Lost. And,
Jin, sorry, Jin Boat, yes.
Right, but Sun said boat, but you were close. It's good enough. Good
Whatever. Enough.
And she's dating him. And then he decides to break up with her. And around the same time, she runs into Randall Park, who she was with, not with, but like best friends with since the time they grew up. They had sex at one point in college and then they fell out of touch. So, of course, he's in love with her, but she isn't in love with him. And she starts dating Keanu Reeves. And now just from a masculinity standpoint, I fucking hate these movies because it's like, dude, if she shows up with another guy and you're still pining over her, like, you're the fucking problem. Just fucking leave. You can do better if she's never going to pay attention to you. The second she breaks up with another guy, she's spending all this time with you, you're about to confess your love, and then she says, I met someone, that's when you peace out, dude. Get the fuck out of there. Don't get stuck into the orbiter trap. This guy's an orbiter. This is Always Be My Maybe is basically Orbiter the movie. And it's interesting to me that they have now tied it into this race thing. Especially because if you think about it, the stereotype of Asian men as being betas and being orbiters. So there's a lot of cultural landmines I feel like Netflix is accidentally stepping into, and I wonder if anyone's ever going to call them out on it. So for me, I don't know, I might have to end up seeing this because my girlfriend might be, oh, it's an all-Asian movie. And I'll be like, didn't you learn anything from Crazy Rich Asians? But for me, this is a tackle.
I feel like we've already reviewed this. I don't know. I have podcast amnesia, so I don't really know what we do on this show most of the time. But this feels very familiar to me. Did we look at a teaser for this or something
before? I don't remember talking about it. William, do you?
No, I don't remember talking about it. But it's so cookie cutter that maybe that's what you're responding to.
Maybe that's why I've just seen this movie now 1,000 times and I don't care anymore. I do like Ali Wong. I love her stand-up. She's very funny.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that can carry me through this tragedy of a plot. So tackle.
Yeah.
William?
I'm going to say no. There's not really much to say here.
Tackle. Second trailer.
Angel Has Fallen is the third movie in the most improbable, second improbable trilogy. Which is more improbable as a trilogy, this trilogy or the John Wick trilogy?
I think this one is less probable.
You said it in a way that confused me.
This trilogy, being the one we're talking about, the Has Fallen trilogy, is less probable of a successful trilogy.
Right, so it's more improbable.
Yes.
Okay, I don't know why you said it the opposite way. It's like when people use double negatives and triple negatives and I start getting confused.
You're the one using the double negative.
Yeah.
You know what?
I took out the double negative.
Shut up.
Right?
All right, so I haven't seen either of the first two movies of this, but even if this was a standalone movie, this would look phenomenal. You don't even have to have seen the first two. I mean, the title's a little weird if you haven't seen the first two. You're like, Angel Has Fallen? What? That doesn't make any sense. But, I mean, even that's based upon a Secret Service speak, right, Daniel? That's where they're getting this terminology from?
At least internal to the series, yes. I don't know about real Secret Service.
Right. I mean, obviously, we don't know what they really say in the Secret Service, but that's the point. So even the title could make sense if you see the movie on its own. So I think even on its own merits, this looks like a great action movie. I mean, Gerard Butler is great. I mean, Morgan Freeman looks good in this. The plot is interesting, right? Why are they setting him up? Who's setting him up? What's going on? What's this conspiracy? This is probably going to turn into John Wick for me, where I just had to watch the first one recently, and I'm going to watch the second one pretty soon here because I want to see the third one while it's still in theaters. And I'm probably going to end up doing this as well, where I binge the first two of these. This is a pretty big hug for me.
Hug.
I think on this show I have spoken the praise of the Has Fallen series before.
Yes.
Which, when I say it like that, makes me think about Cat and Cheeseburgers. Point being that the first two movies are very unapologetically pro-America and pro-American ideas, and sometimes they're a little on point or sort of hit you in the face with it, and they're sort of less nuanced than you would hope, but it is sort of an action movie, so I don't know. Maybe it's exactly what you'd expect. My wife is going to see this about 60 times, so one of those times I will see it. Hug.
Hug.
Guns, explosions, action. I'm in. Let's do this.
Hug. Final trailer.
Astronaut is an interesting case for me. So in this trailer, it looks like a guy is really old and dreams of going to space, and someone like the guy who owns Virgin creates like a private space flight, and he creates a lottery for people to enter to go on the space flight, and this guy starts lying and stuff in order, you know, he says he's younger than he is and he doesn't have an heart condition in order to get on this flight. It sort of comes across like Willy Wonka, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory for an old dude in space. But I'm getting a sense of a really slow pacing for this movie. So I'm really unsure about this. I probably would see it if it got good responses from people I trust. Otherwise, I just don't think with everything that comes out, I'm going to want to be motivated to see this movie, even though there are things I like about it. I like the premise. I like the, you know, the echoing of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I like all of these things. I think it's a very positive, benevolent movie. And I've noticed, Daniel and William, and maybe you guys can touch on this a little bit, I think I'm starting to notice a backlash in the movies. I think maybe we're over the final hurdle, or we're getting over the final hurdle of all these social justice naturalistic crap, because there seems to be a lot more hopeful movies like this. I mean, there was that Trapped Under the Ice movie, which was all super religious but meant to be positive. There's that A Dog's Life. I just saw that movie Palms because my girlfriend wanted to see it. Where there are all these more hopeful stories coming out again, almost these more romantic stories about the triumph of the human spirit and how people can do things they're not expected to do and overcome. So I think maybe there's a backlash coming, and maybe this is the part of it. And I appreciate that element of it. There's just this one in specific. I wouldn't hate seeing it. There's just no reason to get up off the couch and go and see it. So tackle.
A lot of similar feelings, Justin. I thought this looked kind of cool. And then as I'm watching the trailer, I'm thinking, am I watching the entire movie right now? Which seems to be an epidemic in trailers. We have the setup, we have the problem, we have some conflict, we have a resolution point in the trailer. Basically, the only thing we're missing is the denouement. So I feel like I already have seen this movie. And as a result, I would like to hug it, but it's definitely a Netflix and hug kind of movie.
Netflix and hug.
So the only thing I'll add, because I agree with Daniel here, this seems like something I'd be interested in. But then when you go to YouTube, they've disabled comments and dislike. So,
uh-oh.
Yeah, so that's going to lean me in the opposite direction. I'm going to tackle.
Tackle.
Maybe they just didn't want to be attacked by the social justice warriors.
I don't know.
Maybe, but probably not.
Okay.
I don't know. This just seems like Mr. Holland's opus, The Retirement Years.
All right. Well, let's end this episode. I have a brief story from work this week I want to tell. So let's get into it on Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. There's not really sun. No, we just complain, and I hope that this mic is on. Basically, at my job, I deal with the public a lot, where they want to get information from the state about the highway system, the rules, so on and so forth. And often they tell me their stories of why they want to find these things out. And this guy came into the district office, and he was down there, and he just started talking about what was going on. So on a highway that it's not like, you know, like an interstate, but it's like, you know, a highway that's basically got a lot of businesses on it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Limited access. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So limited access, I guess, would be a good way to describe it. I've never heard that term at work, but I may start using it and see how people respond to it. But so he owns a plot of land across from a gas station. Now, this highway intersects with a city street. His lot only has access on a city street. The other lot with the gas station has an access and entrance point on the state route and also on the city street. So he wants to open a gas station because the guy across the street is gouging people. He's charging like $4.29 a gallon. And he's like, well, you could charge like $3.80 a gallon and still make money. He's just able to do that because he has no competition. So immediately I'm like, oh yeah, the capitalist in me, the individualist is like, yeah, this guy should be able to open a gas station. The reason he cannot is, the guy who owns the gas station is trying to say his driveway on the city street would be too dangerous for people to use as an entrance into that lot. Therefore, he can't open up a gas station or any sort of business on that lot. So now there's just an empty lot in California where the grass is overgrown and the property is super valuable. You know, it would cost a lot to have that property. So this guy basically has a lot that has, even though it's super expensive, it has no value to it. And to me, I was sitting there and I was like, this is a perfect example of government overreach. This is the result of it.
Yeah. I think it obviously is an example of government overreach. What the hell are they doing telling people, you know, what they can do with their property, etc.? Is it my property or is it your property? If it's my property, go away. But I think the first thing that popped out to me about your story, Justin, is actually that this highlights that there's somewhat of a myth, at least to some degree, that business in general just doesn't like regulation and that businesses are typically anti-government involvement. I think that is not the case. I think for a large portion of business, not a majority perhaps, but a large percentage, they are good with government involvement as long as they are the incumbent business. As long as they have the established, you know, money-making venture, then they're good with regulation if it keeps out competition. They're good with regulation if it furthers their encampment in the market. This is partially what I think is so insidious about the relationship between business and government, is that out of one side of their mouth, they can talk about, you know, government being less involved, fewer taxes, whatever. But on the other side, they can be saying, yeah, but we need all these regulations for safety. For instance, that's the number one thing they talk about, for safety. We need all these regulations. And all they're wanting to do is keep out competition.
Well, right. And that's what the guy was telling me. He was like, this guy is making an extra $3 million a year. And then he's paying $80,000 to keep this ruling in place that it's not safe to turn into my business. They just see that as an investment in their business, because then the guy can make, what, $2,900,000 by just paying $80,000 to keep this other guy away? It's just the government becomes an investment at that point.
So, William, what businesses are you shutting down now that you're the...
I'm going to kick the Subway and the Jimmy John's out of their spaces and say it's unsafe for people to walk over to there. It's funny because I have to deal with shit like this all the time. Right now there's a concern, lots and lots of concern, because there's the rise, sort of the angle of attack to get into the store is too steep, according to the ADA. And I swear to you, if I just took you to the location right now and you walked up to it, you wouldn't even notice that there was an incline. But it's too much for the ADA, so they're thinking about how the ramp, like how they're going to make a ramp and still have pedestrians be able to walk. And we're actually taking what is a smooth incline and we're going to be forced to put a step there, which you might think, oh, well, as long as there's a ramp, a step's not too bad. I'm just imagining customers like tripping and falling into the store right now because there's going to be a step where there was none before. So, all in the name of government regulation.
That's right.
Well, and actually, couldn't somebody be using that against you? Like, are you going to have to pay for the ADA improvements there?
Thankfully, I don't own the building, so no. But yes, if this was a traditional store, like at a... like in its own building or whatever, then yeah, I would have to pay for it. It's going to be on
the
building.
Right, so somebody could have been using that to keep you from opening by making it cost prohibitive.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, it happens. That sort of thing happens all the time. The sort of overarching point here is that I often joke that I want to start my own nonprofit called the Institute for Property Rights Would Literally Solve Everything. And it's because... we talk about rights nowadays, but we talk about things that are inviolate, like the right to speech, you know, the right to religion or, you know, conscience or whatever it is. But property rights were probably viewed the exact same way by our founders, and for an important reason, which is that property is how we as human beings actualize the work of our mind. It's how we survive. It's how we concretize our survival method.
So saith John Locke.
So saith John Locke and many other important philosophers. But imagine the world we would live in if the legal system and our politicians viewed the right to property just like we view the right to speech nowadays, for instance. But instead, the idea is you never own your property. You can never do what you want with your property. Even if you do have a private property, you find out very quickly that if you don't pay your sales tax, the government will come repossess that property because they own it now, because you're essentially a serf living on the master's land, and you must pay the correct amount to the master. Otherwise, they come take your land away. You don't ever own it. So that's my hyper-libertarian rant to end the show.
Thanks, Liberty Gabby listeners.
It's a super good rant, and the response point to what I can hear someone saying that is the safety issue, right? The guy's using saying, you know, if you turn right into this land, it's unsafe on the city road. So the question about that is, first of all, I would say if it's really unsafe, people are going to stop turning into there and stop going there because it's not going to be worth risking safety just to get gas. That's the first thing, is how the free market would handle it. But what about the idea that people who aren't trying to use the gas station might be put into unsafe conditions because of somebody turning right? First of all, I think this argument is bullshit. I don't think it's unsafe based upon the layout of the land. I just think this is an argument a guy's using. But I can just see somebody responding to a libertarian argument in that way. So what would you say to that argument, that it's not, you can't create unsafe conditions because that's not fair for the greater good?
One, privatize all the roads. The market will do a better job of facilitating safe entrance and exit than government ever could. So there's that. But two, unsafe how, to whom, and in what context? Driving is the most unsafe activity we do on a daily basis anyway. Just getting on any highway is likely far less safe than turning into this guy's gas station. It is not up to the government to decide how we evaluate the safety with which we do things. You know, as long as the guy, it doesn't have like open, you know, what are they called? Landmines, you know, on the entrance to his gas station.
He's got turrets. He's
putting, that's right, automated gun turrets, putting people's lives literally in danger. There are any number of things that are unsafe that we choose to do all the time because we say that the reward is greater than the risk. And when we're talking about unsafe in this context, it's not like 1 in 16 drivers are going to die if they turn into this gas station. It's a moderate, you know, raise in risk because people have to slow down on a busy road, which happens literally all the time, every day, everywhere else in the country.
Right, and it's near an intersection, yeah, which is like driving a city.
Bringing it back to my step example, which is more unsafe to more people? If this incline might be slightly more dangerous for the occasional wheelchair person that comes into my store, or changing it to a step and it literally being more likely for every single person that walks or crutches their way into the store, right? Like the step is clearly more dangerous than having a slightly more steep incline.
And let's say the government has a legitimate state interest in saying something is safe or unsafe. I don't think they really do, especially in this context, but let's say they do. I still don't think that then goes to the argument of, therefore, you can't build a business on this property. They might, you know, if you can have sort of benevolent regulation, makes me shudder to even say that. If you're going to have that, then the mandate would be something like, you have to build out some sort of entrance in here that's going to allow people to, like, offshoot a little bit so that they're out of the way of the general traffic flow or something. And then you can build your business. I still think that's overreach, but that is at least less egregious of an overreach than simply saying,
well, even
saying,
then,
no,
Daniel,
you're
wouldn't
done.
You say, since we don't live in the world where the road is private, wouldn't you try to engineer it in that way? Wouldn't you say, like, hey, the road in front of your business is here to serve you, right? And the people flowing through there. And so, you know, there might be some conflicts there, but like, hey, we're trying to maximize the flow through this artery of the street and try to serve the actual things that are there, right? So the job isn't on the person or the property owner, right? The job is on the road owner, quote unquote, which is the state in this case.
Absolutely. Even better, kind of. Private property rights would solve everything.
All right, let's put a bow on this episode. What did we learn this trip, Daniel?
I learned that I never took the SATs, but had I, man, I would have gotten into some good schools because I lived in some crappy neighborhoods, even though I was privileged because I'm white, remember? Half white. But so I missed out on that gravy train.
William?
I learned that the governor of Alabama, Kay Ivey, is a white man.
Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that it is still a shock to some people that women are posting half-naked pictures on Instagram.
Yeah. Well, if you've been on Instagram, you know that that is basically the norm. But you won't find any of those on the midside social media. Sorry, folks. But so you can go there to get actual content for the shows. Follow us on social media at The Midside everywhere. Share all of our posts. Thank you. TheMidside.com/podcast is where you go to listen to all the past episodes, including past reviews of movies and such, including Snyder series and the Nolan notes. We'll do more of those at some point in the future. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Google Play and help us by leaving a 5-star review. Patreon.com/TheMidside. You can go and give us a couple bucks every time we produce a piece of content. Thank you. Helps us keep the lights on. And Liberty.me. We talked about you earlier. Thanks for syndicating us to all you libertarians out there. Yeah, no problem with you folks this week. But tell a friend. That's really the most important part. It's coming up to summer season. We're all going to be active outside, jogging, walking, biking, whatever other ings that you do outside. Take your headbuds, your earbuds, your AirBuds, your AirPods, your AirPhones, your headphones, and all those with you. And when someone says, hey, what are you listening to? Tell them The Midside Podcast, which you can get on all the platforms. That helps us grow the show. And until next time, we love you lots.
This concludes your journey into The Midside. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
I got nothing.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am not a genius.
God damn it.